Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the third episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives podcast. This is Chris Larson, reporter for BHB, your go-to source for behavioral health news and insights. For this episode, I interviewed Doreen Grandpichet, the founder and longtime CEO of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, one of the largest autism therapy providers in the United States. It's also a company that holds a significant place in the recent history of the autism therapy segment. Doreen is what some in the business academia space call a boomerang CEO, meaning that she's come back to a company that she led for a time after stepping away. I get into the details of that with Doreen in this pod, but for context, listeners need to know that Doreen and her business partner have acquired CARD as part of bankruptcy proceedings that kicked off in June. She left the CEO role in 2019, but held a minority ownership stake in the company during the interim. The deal to acquire CARD closed at the end of August. I caught up with Doreen soon thereafter to talk about where CARD came from, how it managed its years-long streak of growth, and how it will navigate the business headwinds that led CARD to bankruptcy in the first place. But before we get into that conversation, I just want to say a hearty thank you for tuning in and helping me and the rest of the BHB crew grow this new aspect of our journalism. You can find, rate, and share the three episodes that we now have up on SoundCloud and Apple Music. BHB is able to bring you the latest and greatest industry news and now exclusive candid podcast conversations because of the wonderful relationships we've been able to build over a short period of time. So reach out at any time to get the conversation going at podcasts@bhbusiness.com. Okay, let's get into it. Doreen, thank you for being here.
It's such a pleasure, Chris.
So you recently closed on a deal to acquire CARD, a large ABA provider that you founded and led for many years from Blackstone. I want to help our listeners understand key background information before we talk about the deal and the future of CARD. So let's start here. When did you start this company and what did the autism therapy industry look like back then?
Well, let's see. I started the company in 1990. I actually got involved with autism in 1979, working at UCLA, and finished my doctorate at UCLA and started CARD in 1990. And the world of autism was quite different. First of all, the prevalence was much lower. I believe it was something around 1 in 10,000 children. There was very limited, if any, funding. The only source of funding really other than parents themselves was Social Security or Department of Developmental Services type of funding. And it was pretty difficult to actually provide services to a lot of children, but then there weren't that many children or that many patients around. And it was a very different world, Chris. We had just in 1987 published the article that showed children with autism can actually recover. And as a result, every patient that came and requested this type of therapy, which, by the way, was called behavior modification back then, was very, very committed to doing intensive therapy because their goal was to recover their child. And so there wasn't kind of a distribution of, oh, I want to do 10 hours a week or something. It was every patient was coming in and requesting 40 hours. So it was more a much more intensive type of program back then. And also, I think we had, over the years, of course, we've learned a lot more in terms of the content and the style of the therapy. ABA has advanced as a science. And things have changed quite a bit, but, you know, it was a much more, I guess, pure period of the science just beginning.
I gotcha. And you referred to a specific date there, 1987. Just very briefly, what was that? What came out then that helped inform ABA going forward?
Yeah, so we had a pretty small clinic at UCLA. Initially, it was called the Autism Project. I was there for 12 years with Lovos. And then later we renamed the clinic as the Clinic for the Behavioral Treatment of Children. And Professor Lovos he was the primary person who kind of took the principles of behavioral psychology and applied them to autism. And so his concept was, you know, children with autism can learn. and let's figure out how we can teach them all the things that they need to learn. So we originally started working with children, this is so long ago that it was pre-deinstitutionalization. So a lot of our initial patients were in Camarillo State Hospital, which was, you know, several autism wards. But over time, we realized that, you know, we have to really publish on the fact that children with autism will do very well if you do intensive behavioral therapy with them. So a study was conducted at our clinic, which basically took three different groups of children. It had the group that we were treating intensively. So, and when I say we were using students at UCLA, and they were all kind of going through a series of courses where they would learn what is now the basics of ABA. And in those days, as I said, it was called behavior modification. And so these students would work with the children. I mean, that's how I started myself, by the way, as an undergrad. And once we had one group that was receiving about 40 hours a week of one-to-one therapy, another group that was receiving about 10 hours a week just because they were very far from UCLA, and a third group, which were the children receiving treatment at a different part of UCLA called, now it's changed to Semel Institute, used to be the Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA. So, fast forward approximately 3 years, and we showed that the children who were receiving the intensive services, about half of them had, for all practical purposes, recovered. And so they had normal IQ, they had been integrated into regular education and were doing extremely well. Whereas from the other two groups, only 2% of the children had reached those goals. So this study came out in 1987, and it was probably the seminal study in our field that kind of made the world realize, oh, autism doesn't have to be lifelong, and you can benefit from behavioral therapy. And then, you know, obviously there were many replications after that and many studies that ultimately led to health insurance coming in.
I got you. And you mentioned the name Lovaas. That's Dr. Ivor Lovaas, who was a seminal figure in the research of using these behavioral therapies on autism. Just a quick note of context for the listener. So let's go to, I guess, what I would assume is an early phase for CARD. Mm-hmm. From a business perspective, why did you see the company growing, as large as it eventually did? And then what did you see that made you think that it would be something that could be really big and successful?
Yeah, I love talking about the history of CARD. So, you know, when I started, I had just left UCLA, and this was before the kind of field of ABA really existed as it's on its own. I was a licensed psychologist. And so I started treating children who were coming out of UCLA. UCLA's clinic was a very small research-oriented clinic. And so a lot of the patients who wanted ongoing therapy kind of moved over with me. I started hiring therapists. It was a very small operation. I did everything, right? Hiring people, training them, billing patients for them, seeing the patients, report writing, everything. And gradually, a few of the parents whose children had done very well started to write books about the interventions. One of them was Catherine Maurice. She wrote a book that two of her children had been treated with my supervision and had done extremely well. Lots of parents started reaching out to me from different parts of the country, requesting that I come and open a clinic where they were. And I was originally in the LA area. I had a very small clinic, treating maybe about 20, 25 children at that time. And so parents started kind of reaching out. And this is, again, it's quite a long time ago, and it was before we had a lot of technology, right? So in terms of the internet, it was before AOL, right? It was the only source of AOL, of internet at that time was this thing called Prodigy, which later went away. And parents had formed a sort of what would be classified as a chat room, I guess, now, on Prodigy, and it was called the Me List, and that's because one of Lovaas's books was called the Me Book, And so these were all parents all over the country who had read about his work and were very interested in getting their children treated through this methodology. One of those parents, actually, I started treating his child, and the child did very well. He was in the Northern California area. And so he posted on Prodigy. He called me and said, can you please open a clinic up here in Northern Cal? And I said, sure, if you have about 20, 25 patients, it's feasible for me to come up there and open a clinic. So he wrote on there, hey, who's around the San Jose area? And a lot of parents got together and we ended up opening a center. And I sent someone up there who I had trained to provide supervision. So he then wrote on this list, you know, if you have 20 or 25 children who want services, Doreen will come out and open a card center there. And that was pretty much the only marketing for the next, let's say, 10 years or so, because I had so many patients reach out to me. I think next was North Carolina, New York, of course. I mean, lots of different areas, even outside of the U.S. So one of the early clinics was in England, in London, then Australia. I just went all over the place and started opening these sites. So as time is going on, prevalence is also beginning to pick up. And, you know, we gradually, at the early years, I was forming the structure and the infrastructure of the company, which took a lot of work. And I was still building the staff. So it was a, you know, smaller company and growing gradually. I would say by probably the early 2000s, we came to the realization that no matter how fast we grow, we're opening sites, which really was more like something about five a year. We were just not keeping up. The prevalence was increasing. People were requesting services all over the world, and we just could not keep up with it. And I want to just interject here that I think one of the reasons CARD was able to grow was because several people who joined me in the very, very early 90s when I first opened CARD were with me throughout the 30 years that I was CEO of CARD. And that was a big part of the success, because these folks, I call them seniors, knew the company. They had been part of the growth of the company from the very beginning. And they were sort of, you know, the same as me. They were my eyes, my ears. They controlled so many different aspects of what was happening in the company. And I'm happy to say a lot of those folks have come back now as well. But anyway, so fast forward to first of all, I mean, I have to say the growth was very constrained based on funding, right? So in the early 2000s, some families in Arizona, particularly one family who was very influential in Arizona, reached out and said, hey, we want to provide funding, public funding. Can you come out and help us with this? And so that family was very successful in getting a bill to pass in Arizona, and we were able to get health insurance coverage. And that bill was then taken by folks at Autism Speaks, and they are really responsible for the tremendous work that they did and were able to just disseminate these bills across the states one by one and get health insurance coverage. That, of course, as you know, Chris, changed our industry pretty tremendously and very rapidly. I was very lucky in that I had two people, I think, many, many people, honestly, that were integral to the success of CARD. One of them was Bryce Myler, who was a parent who joined me very early on before we had health insurance coverage. And she started setting CARD up to be ready for health insurance coverage. And I think we got a head start there with her help. And another one was my partner and friend, Sangam Pant, who is again my partner now. He joined me in about 12 to 14. He was kind of joining me gradually. And by 14, he was with me as a partner at CARD, and he had a business background. He had also himself been at Evercore, which was a very successful firm. And he came in, and then we really took off. And it was Sangam and I, even today, I would say we kind of function as almost the same person. We always have the same problem solving, same solutions. We think very much alike. So he kind of took over a lot of the aspects of finance at CARD, and as well as expansion. And I was then focused on clinical and operations, HR, and all these other areas. And together we were able to just grow much faster. We had a tremendously strong team of people who were internal Cardians, as we call them. They were folks who had, you know, just like us, just like me, they were mostly clinicians. They had started out as behavior technicians, had become supervisors, then later gotten their BCBAs and had just grown with CARD. And of course, they were all over the country, you know, doing spectacular things. And a large part of the success and growth of CARD was because of these folks. It wasn't that we at any point decided, oh, you know, we need to open 260 sites. It just was an ongoing process. Everywhere we went, there was still an additional need. A lot of parents were reaching out with wait lists. We were trying to keep up with them. And it just became a natural progression that we would continue opening sites.
I gotcha. So if you were to kind of pick a key year or narrow span of years where these forces started to converge and really help accelerate the growth, and these key factors we're talking about are the state insurance mandates, increasing surveillance, and the better detection of autism as a condition, and then of course continuous demand throughout both of those factors. So like if you were to pick a year or a narrow range of years that really were key for the accelerated growth of the company, what would those years be?
I'd say they would be 2015 to 17. Those years we were just, you know, we had figured out kind of the formula, let's put it that way. And we had a very good system in place to scale up. And so those years were very key.
Right. So you're meeting this high demand. And just for a little bit of context, the estimated prevalence of autism in the United States in 2000 was about 1 in 150 children or so. But by the time we get to 2016, according to CDC data, that rate had halved down to 1 in 54 children. Massive detection increases, and therefore huge demand for your company to meet, as well as other companies as well. But let's go ahead and talk about what happens just a year later. April 18, Blackstone announces that they're going to acquire a 70% stake in the company. Was that the first time all the way in 2017 that the firm had engaged with outside investors?
Yeah, I never had any kind of outside funding. The company, we managed it pretty closely, I would say. And any funding that, you know, we would raise funds ourselves through revenue and then go ahead and allocate them to further growth or to research. At one point, I think it was in the around 2015 or so, or 16, maybe, we were the largest private company that contributed to research. We put a couple of $1 million into research every year. We were very, very dedicated, had a pretty large research department, also a pretty large development group. We were developing training, online training, and as well as our skills platform, which is called our electronic medical records system. So we were doing a lot of development and research, and yeah, it was all going well. We didn't require funding, and we were able to reinvest. Now, what happened was that we had opened, I think, over maybe 150 or so clinics during those last couple of years, from 2016 and 17. And honestly, these clinics were great. I mean, they had the infrastructure and they were doing well, but it was getting to the point where it was very difficult to manage, right? And we were exhausted. Like, we were working very, very long hours, very hard for many years now. And Sangam and I both, and as well as my core team of leadership, which was, as I said, pretty much predominantly clinicians, we felt that, you know, if we were to get to 300, I think we were at 260 when we were making these decisions, and we were like, we're holding the company back because we don't have enough span. We can't expand more and keep it under control more. Like, it was just getting too difficult. And we all felt that bringing in an investor like Blackstone might help us expand. That was the whole reason for this. I mean, I had been approached by a variety of investors all the way back to like the early 2000s, actually. And I was never really interested because I kind of saw the path and I wanted to stay on the path. Around 2017 or so, it had gotten to the point where other, the private equity industry had entered our field. So there were other providers that were either growing through acquisition faster than we were, or I just felt that, oh, we need help expanding beyond this number. And I didn't really want to be, we were at that time, I think, the largest in the industry. And we had a seat at the table, let's put it that way. We could have conversations with some of the payers and help modify things. But really, it was getting to the point where, you know, there was others coming into the field and they were getting bigger and had more backing. So it was really a very short period of time, Chris. It was January of 2018. I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go to the JP Morgan healthcare conference and see what's going on. We went, we had, I think, 36 different groups were interested in meeting with us and wanting to get involved with CARD. It was only a few months of just interviews and so on. And ultimately, I decided to choose Blackstone because I felt that they were kind of parallel to CARD in the sense that they were very, very big in the private equity world. And I felt they would have a lot of resources available to us to help open doors. And that was, you know, help us. We wanted to, at that time, bring in other services. We wanted to expand where it pertained to funding. And we felt that Blackstone would do a very good job with that. So that's kind of when we partnered with them.
Right. So let me make sure I'm kind of picking up at least a couple of the key themes here with what was going on around 2017 and 2018. It sounds like things were going well. You had grown the company to a point where you needed to find another partner to bring into the organization to help it get to the next level. You were successful in being able to do so. But then not too many years later, 2020 rolled around and we all faced the coronavirus pandemic. But my understanding is that by around that time, you had stepped out of the daily management of the company and moved more to a board role. So when did you move into more of that board role as opposed to managing it as the CEO?
Yeah, so we, you know, the plan was that I would continue as CEO for a couple of years until we could find someone to come in as CEO. And then that would give me more of an opportunity to, slow down a little bit and enjoy life a little bit. I've been working most of my life very heavy hours, but also that I would still have some influence on what needed to be done as a board member. So I remained CEO until the very end of 2019. So basically 2 years after we sold. And, at that point, obviously, nobody knew that COVID is coming. And we brought in a CEO at the last month of 2019. We had a very short period of overlap. And at that time, then I stepped back and became just a board member. And he took over. And, I make fun and say that I had about a week off because as soon as COVID started, I reached out and obviously said, I'm here if you need any help and what would you like to do? And then re-engaged as a board member now. So I was kind of on calls every morning trying to help guide him as to how to deal with COVID. Because obviously, as you know, all of the CEOs, I'm sure, of all the providers at that time were closing down, learning new procedures for safety and health, figuring out how to adjust to telehealth, all these sorts of things. And so he wasn't very familiar with kind of the clinics yet and the practice. So I was pretty involved with him for a little while until just the first few months of COVID, I would say the first half of 2020. And then, you know, gradually just stepped back and became a board member as it relates to CARD. I continued to do some of my own kind of social media work and my show where I answer parents' questions and started writing again, that sort of thing.
I gotcha. So looking at, where, COVID took the industry, it took it into a really difficult space for several of the largest, and even some of the providers that, one might think might be somehow insulated because of their relative smallness or their concentration in markets. But this ultimately resulted in Card going through a bankruptcy proceeding. And in those proceedings, the coronavirus was pointed to as, as one of the great impetuses for that move. So, at the end of the day, every bankruptcy is about either a household or a business not quite being able to balance and service their debt obligations. And that's ultimately what got, Card into bankruptcy in the first place. But what was it about the pandemic that was ultimately so disruptive? There was a time, yes, where people were under these really strict mandates, but that was only a couple months, and then people started to make their reentry back into normal life.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say, I think a few different things. I mean, I think, first of all, so I was, I stayed on the board of Card for another year after that. And I ended up resigning from the board in early 2022. And so the bottom line is, I think that COVID, I think it took Card a little bit longer, perhaps, just because we had new leadership and it took a little bit longer to kind of figure out exactly how to adjust, perhaps. But I think it's in addition to that, I think there were a few other things. People point to kind of the debt, but we didn't really have, they didn't bring on debt immediately, right? There was a percentage of debt that came on, but it wasn't just the debt. The company was very, very healthy at this point and was able to kind of handle the debt. I think it's what you just said very well, Chris, that there was a slight imbalance of, expense and revenue. And that tends to happen, I think, when you bring in large infrastructure all at once, right? I mean, the difference, I think, was that over the course of the years that we were building Card, it was a very gradual process of adding expensive things, whether it was a new leadership that needed to have a higher compensation, or it was a new ERP that cost us a lot, or whatever it was all gradual. And I think when our private equity investor came in, there was a lot of, let's make these upgrades happen right away. And that is expensive. And coupled with sort of the reduced revenue that was a result of the initial hit with COVID, I think those two things coming together at the same time, and then a completely new management, right? I mean, when we were running the company, it was a very, very small group of us. I mean, Sangam and I ran it very lean and very flat. So predominantly the majority of the company would either come to me or him. And it wasn't multiple layers of leadership, which, when you're building a large corporation, that kind of thing is necessary. And I think that over time, it would have probably worked if it was done more gradually. But, in Card's case, it all happened all at once, right? So the debt came in, there were additional expenses that came in all at once. Revenue was impacted by COVID. And more importantly, I think employees were impacted by COVID, right? Even though the safety protocols changed and allowed us to resume, I think the employment workforce, the workforce has a different attitude towards life after COVID. And that has impacted everyone. But all of that together, I think, is what caused Card to struggle. And once you start struggling, when it's a corporation, and like some of the things that I disagreed with or I would do differently personally is that a lot of centers were shut down because they were just struggling, right, and trying to cut costs. And the way that we would have operated that in the past is that we would have gone in and tried to figure out why they're struggling. And let's see if we can help them, and let's see if we can turn things around. And that sort of thing, that might have helped. I don't know. It's easy to say after the fact. But so management took direction that was a little bit different than the direction that I would have taken. And perhaps That's also because I'm a clinician, right? So I never entered this field thinking I'm going to become wealthy from this work. I entered the field because I cared about every child that I treated and the families. I mean, honestly, for me, it was more the moms. I was very, very connected to the moms and felt like I can't abandon these people and I got to do more for them. I still feel that way. And I think that feeling of doing the work for the right reasons needed to be, I guess, you know, emphasized, and especially post-COVID, because I think post-COVID in general, the world changed and people started thinking about what are the things that are important to us, right? Everybody had someone who was sick or in the hospital or almost died or passed away, whatever. And it was a kind of a wake-up call for everyone. And we all started thinking, what are the things that really matter? And so I think if we had at that time had someone in CARD who had a very big voice about the mission of the company and why we're still here, what are we supposed to be doing? That would have made a difference, I think. And unfortunately, the focus, I think, was more focused on just developing the business, strengthening the business. And that caused all of the infrastructure to kind of gradually go into bankruptcy. I think all of our companies, us providers, we all need to focus on three things. One is our employees. The second one is our patients. And the third one is our business. And all of those three things work together, right? If we don't take care of our home, you can see what happens. If we don't take care of our employees, ultimately it leads to the same place. And if we don't take care of our patients, then we shouldn't be here to begin with. So it's kind of, you know, those three things all have to be taken care of. And I think we just didn't pay attention to them all at once.
I gotcha. And you've already previously mentioned that there is now this reassembling of at least some members of a previous management team that helped get the company to where it was in the recent past. As part of that, are you going to step into the CEO role?
Yes, yes. And I'm very excited about it. Our deal closed just 5 days ago. Right? We actually took over on the 28th, which is Monday, a few days ago. And yes, this is just, you know, honestly a blessing and a testament to how much fun we had building CARD. But yes, several of the key folks have come back. Very, very grateful to them for that. Some of them actually stayed at CARD over the years, and that was also a very wonderful thing. Obviously, as we were watching what's happening with CARD, Sangam and I got together and said, listen, we can't let CARD end like this, right? This can't be the end of this story. And what can we do to get back involved? And so it was quite a process. It was, you know, just months of looking at data and trying to figure out if we're going to have solutions to some of the issues, and also game plan. Like, what are we going to do? Which I'm happy to talk about. But yes, a big part of it was bringing back some of the senior folks and having them step into roles that they were already very familiar with and could kind of hit the ground running. So yeah, I've become CEO again, and Sangam is president, and we're going to try to bring back kind of the same sort of leadership that we had last time.
And at least historically speaking, and by historically, I mean in the story that you've shared with us so far about where you were at with the company, you know, circa 2017, 2018, you were looking at maybe slowing down a little bit. So if that was where you were at back then, why change the tack to getting back into the daily management of a huge company?
Yeah, I ask myself that every night at midnight when I've spent 15 hours working. Yeah, I just couldn't, and I have to tell you, I was just beginning to really enjoy retirement and kind of a different schedule and lifestyle. But the truth is that we couldn't walk away from it. You know, we couldn't. CARD is my whole life, right? I mean, I started CARD in 1990, so it is my life. It's, you know, I dedicated most of my adult life to building CARD. And it was very meaningful for me, not just because of all the families that we helped and the children, but also because of the employees who later succeeded in their own way. A lot of my folks went on and opened new sites or new clinics, their own businesses and practices, became professors, trained others. I mean, they just, a lot of people who somehow started with me have changed the world of ABA and autism, which is beautiful. And it's meaningful. And to you know, look back and say, oh, it was wonderful while it lasted, but then CART is gone, you know, or it just failed and that was the end of it, it was too bitter. I couldn't just let that be. And so, and also I'm the type of person, and so is Sang, and we both enjoy kind of problem solving. And we felt, you know, this is a problem we're familiar with and maybe we can get involved and solve and help a lot of families and help a lot of employees and just make it better again. So it was quite motivating to do that.
I gotcha. Now that you have the company back, you're going to be taking over as CEO. How are you going to run it differently and make sure that it doesn't run into the same issues that we've talked about already that potentially led to the bankruptcy?
Right, right. So we started engaging after the auction. The auction ended, I think it was like end of July. So we've had roughly a month. And during this period of time, we kind of divided to the tasks. And I'd say another person who came back and joined us is our old general counsel, Michael Costa, who's been an incredible source of just power for us getting to where we are now. What we did is Sangam took over all of the vendor agreements and started renegotiating and reducing cost on those. And an organization the size of CART had hundreds of vendor contracts that were, and a lot of those contracts were honestly too big for the size of the company that it is now. So it was a matter of getting out of those contracts, which as a new company, which we are now, we could reestablish new contracts. So he took that. Michael took over the task of payers and assuming all the payer agreements, and with the help of some very talented people at CART that we have right now, they also started working on that. And so we were able to, in a short period of time, and I have to say the payer relations department, kudos to them, because they've been dealing with, you know, Medicaid contracts as well as commercial contracts. And we only had 1 month to try to transfer as many of those as possible. And so they started doing that. And I started working on employment and getting employees back in. And so I had roughly a couple of weeks, I would say, to rehire all the employees that we wanted to keep. So as we were doing this, our goal was to save as well, to bring in as many savings as we can. And we were successful. We were able to, as I said, Sangam and I taking over allowed us to kind of make the hierarchy more flat. A lot of the cost that was associated with the top level of the employment world, we were able to make that much less, reduce the comp and have some savings there, have some savings from the vendor contracts and so on. And so we're starting out with a much more lean company. And that's the answer, Chris. Like, we have to keep this company lean. And we have to operate, again, going back to those three things I said. We have to be able to take care of our patients, our staff, but also pay attention to the business, which essentially means going back to doing things like, you don't outsource every single function. If you can handle it, you do some of these things internally, in-house. It really just depends, right? But keeping cost at the forefront and making sure that while you're taking care of your employees, you're also watching out for the additional cost that's coming to the company from a variety of different sources. So it's really just managing the books a little bit more carefully. And, you know, I have some things planned that I think will continue to bring in parents and increase our incoming patients. CART over the last few years had started to restrict its patients to younger children because their attempt was to really focus on early intervention. I'm not going to do that. We've changed that, and we're going to open the clinics up to all patients of all ages. In fact, ultimately, you know, I used to have several adult centers that were closed down over the last few years, and I want to really go back and reestablish the adult centers, reestablish the programs that were for adolescents, teens, like really focus on the entire population and spectrum of autism. So there will be some changes. As I said, I'm very quick. Right now, one of the folks that came back is a gentleman called Hank Moore. He was with CART from the very beginning, from the mid-90s. And so he's taking over operations. And as soon as he can get, a good feel for operations and has his hands around the whole aspect of operations, my plan is to get back out and start traveling, start meeting the employees, start to get to know everyone again, understand what the issues are at the sites, really get focused on fixing those things and listening to people. I'm a very, very hands-on CEO. Although it's a bigger company, it's still half the size of what I'm used to. So it's not that hard for us to interact with our employees and just get really focused on what they need in order to do their jobs better. I think when you're happy at your work, when you're motivated, when you feel like you actually have an impact on the world, you're going to keep driving. And I just want to get all the Cardians back to that point where they're just excited about the impacts of what they do every day. So yeah, those are our goals.
So then what is the company's number one challenge today?
Oh, right now the challenge is we're understaffed. I mean, we had our clinics, right now if you compare the number of behavior technicians to the number that we had when I left, they're about half. So we are very, very much understaffed, and we need to heavily start working on recruiting and retention. Now, the fortunate thing is, we saw that also, of course, turnover had increased. And I think that's kind of a typical thing also for some of the other providers. I mean, this is an industry where I think people come in, they're young, and they don't know yet necessarily how difficult this job is, right? And so we have to make sure that we pay attention to our BTs. And that's one of the things I'm very, very focused on, is taking care of our behavior technicians in lots of different ways. We used to have lots of bonus programs for the behavior technicians. We used to have point system, all kinds of good stuff that doesn't exist anymore, which I am going to re-implement gradually. And so I really want to just enrich the lives of the folks at the various clinics. I don't think that it's all about turnover, though. They had narrowed their recruiting focus so that they were bringing in people of a particular type in order to really focus on the early intervention. I'm going to broaden that a little bit and open the funnel so we get more people in. And we're going to increase our training again. A lot of the folks that come to CARD really speak highly of the training they receive at CARD, and I'd like to be able to provide that again. Just as I said, I think the focus for a lot of people who last, the people who come in and they last and turn this into a career, are people that are mission-driven. And it really is about reminding everyone at every clinic that this is about the mission, and giving them a sense of just helping them realize how much of an impact they have on the lives of children with autism and their entire families.
So looking forward to the future, will CARD stay the same size that it is now?
Thank you. Yeah, so initially, yes. I mean, we have a lot of work to do with the existing clinics, right? So we have right now just 112 clinics, and our focus will be to get all of those clinics at to capacity. That's going to be our primary focus. But then, and who knows after that, the direction that we might take. I do want to go back and expand in certain regions that we used to have a presence, and there's a very, very high need. A lot of folks reached out to me. CARD at one point, the previous management shut down like 10 clinics in Oregon, and I had so many families reach out to me, and I just felt terribly sad that I couldn't help them. So I do have a goal to go into states where there's 1 year, 2 year wait lists and try to help. We do also, as I said, really want to expand back into adult centers and provide services to children older than age four again. So there will be some expansion, but I think the first year or so will be really focused on maximizing what we have right now.
Doreen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Chris. And thank you so much for all the good work you do. I always enjoy reading your articles. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us on the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives podcast. If you're interested in engaging with us as a guest or a sponsor, reach out at podcast@bhbusiness.com. I'm Chris Larson, reporter for Behavioral Health Business, a part of Aging Media Network and WTWH Media.